the October 14th, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, Wasatch and Summit Counties.
We're going to have a good show this morning. We're first going to be joined by author William Hoagland. He's going to discuss his new book, The Hamilton Scheme. No song and dance there.
Then Bill DeLeon, partner and founder of Mountain Wine Storage down in Heber. And we'll finish our hour by speaking with Kevin Jessup and Chris Badger to share Utah 100 awards.
When Lin-Manuel Miranda made Alexander Hamilton a household name in the 21st century, the long-term implications of his career go far beyond Broadway. His views on capitalism and the role of government continue to affect the nature of our economy and our society today. Author William Hoagland was not going to miss his shot at explaining the importance of Hamilton, and he does so in a new book, The Hamilton Scheme, an epic tale of money and power in the American founding. We're very lucky to be joined by author Hoagland this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, actually, quite a long time, because I've been writing about Hamilton for a long time and studying him. And so well before the musical came along, I was kind of involved in Hamilton stuff. And before the musical came along, it was sometimes part of my job to just let people know that Hamilton existed, like who he was, and but he was the first Treasury Secretary and all that stuff. Since the musical, I have not had to do that as much. But it's a kind of a summation of work I've been doing for, like, I don't know, almost 20 years, actually. But it does, you know, it bounces off the fact that Hamilton is now a known quantity, and yet there's a lot about him that we don't know that I think makes him even more fascinating.
And I think there's probably, you know, given the time I spent with the book over the weekend, there's probably some things that you, from watching the musical, you come away with that probably aren't all that accurate. But we'll get to that. Before we get to economic policy, let's start with a little bit of background about Hamilton the man. Talk a little bit about who he is and how he came to a position of power in the new nation.
Well, it's interesting to think about how he rose in the founding period. You know, he shows up here right as the revolution's breaking out. I mean, almost right as, a little before, which for him, you know, I mean, was a great stroke of luck, actually, and catapulted him into positions he might not otherwise have had, because he was very ambitious and very able. He was very able. He ends up on Washington's staff just very quickly. And you know, there's a story of Hamilton that's sort of like, he was the perpetual outsider, you know, the guy who had to really scratch and claw to break in. You know, in my reading of Hamilton, actually, it was surprisingly easy for him to move up in the world that was presented to him here in what became the United States. So early on, at a very young age, a very able person and very ambitious, he's on Washington's staff, and he's marrying into, you know, one of the most powerful and rich families in the country, in the revolutionary elite, the Schuyler family. They weren't keeping him out. They were pulling him in and embracing him from an early age, and he ran with that. He had great talents, and great talents for pushing himself forward, but also big ideas about what the country really ought to look like if the revolution could, in fact, be won.
So let's sort of try to set up the story a little bit. Obviously, the story begins with a lot of focus on public debt and its treatment. Can you explain what was the role of public debt in society around the time of the revolution, and how did it give rise to different interests?
Well, we couldn't really have fought the revolution without borrowing money, because there just wasn't the money in any sort of concentrated, organized form to fight a war, especially a war against, you know, Britain, the British army and the British government, which had plenty of money. But the reason they had plenty of money in Britain, and this is what Hamilton sort of got on top of, this interesting fact. I mean, Britain wasn't sitting on huge wealth so much as it had a system of finance that involved also borrowing from the richest citizens and creating kind of a pool of money that government could tap into. That's the public debt. And Hamilton thought that since we were borrowing money from rich Americans to fight the war, then that actually could be a sustainable situation in which you could make sure you paid those Americans, that small group of sort of speculators in America, pay them regular annual interest, which would yoke the class that had that kind of money, small group of people, to, you know, great national aims and great national interests. So you connect you consolidate essentially power and money in government and private wealth, and you can actually build pretty quickly. This was his vision. You could pretty quickly build a surprisingly vibrant, surprisingly dynamic national situation in a place where really there hadn't been anything like that until he got this idea.
And when you talk about building a national coalition, I think we need to do a little bit of an aside to talk a little bit about the different perspectives of what we called continentalists versus state sovereignty supporters and how this is going to relate to the treatment of that debt.
Yeah, because Hamilton had this vision, and then there were a lot of people who had a completely different vision. They did not want the government to be consolidated in this way because they believed each state should retain maximum sovereignty of its own. And you have Hamilton on one side, and on his side are Washington and Robert Morris, the great financier of the Revolution, and many others, the Schuyler family, and people we know as early founders. But there were also people on the other side who are famous, like Patrick Henry and other very important and very upscale American revolutionaries, who had a completely different vision for the future of the country that would not have involved a consolidated national structure, but would have retained kind of the confederation structure of, 13 sovereign entities that were joined together to fight a war and manage things that way, but not really a national government that would act upon citizens throughout all of the states. So the Continentalists, that was Hamilton's crowd, were at odds with these state sovereignty people, and this was one of the great conflicts in the governing elite of the day.
Interesting. I like that. Now, just a quick aside. The book relays information about George Washington as both an investor and landowner. It's not widely discussed. Does this explain, in part, how he ends up aligned with Hamilton's plan?
Yeah, I think it explains it in the sense, Washington's, business interests are not discussed as much as a lot of the other things he did. And yet, to Washington himself, these business interests were of paramount importance. He'd been working on them since he was a teenager, basically, trying to get ahead in Virginia society from a position of some disadvantage in that society. And he'd been very successful in a lot of ways, and he was fairly obsessively involved in land speculation. And for him, this is the funny thing about Washington. He was, they call him the indispensable man, and he kind of was, I think, the indispensable man. But to him, his class of people and himself kind of getting ahead in this speculative manner was not at odds at all with building out the country. This is what, this is what they thought, he and others thought, building out the country really meant. It meant creating situations in which people could consolidate large amounts of land and benefit from that, people like him. And so, it's not the most edifying aspect of Washington's career to us now, but at the time, he and people in his class did not see a conflict there. They saw this as, what was good for George Washington really kind of was good for the country, and what was good for the country as a nation, as a national government, was pretty good for George Washington.
I want to sort of get to, the so-called Hamilton scheme, but can you sort of, before we do that, there are forces that we've been talking about, wealthy money interests that, invest in the debt and are concerned about having it repaid in a positive way, and there's also, obviously, revolutionary soldiers who are interested in being paid. Talk a little bit about who's on the other side of this discussion, and, some of the people that you talked about in the book where Washington went to visit, there were people who were squatting on his land. Obviously, there's a whole sort of movement of people who have a different perspective. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, these people don't get talked about much, and yet, what we're talking about really is the majority of, free laboring people in the country, the people who are doing all the work, including, as you just mentioned, being foot soldiers in the Revolution. You have, the Continentalists, and then you have the state sovereignty people in the governing elite, but you've got a huge number of people who are not in the governing elite and who don't get talked about a lot, although many of them had their own ideas about what the future of the country ought to look like and how this revolution might benefit them. So they are at odds kind of with the whole governing elite. So the way I put this, it kind of triangulates the story. It isn't just Hamiltonians versus Jeffersonians. That's part of it. But it's also Hamiltonians versus Jeffersonians versus a movement of ordinary people who really thought that the way financial, and economic policy ought to work in an independent America would benefit them. And that's why they were fighting the war, in part. So when the war is over, you get some significant conflicts between Hamiltonianism, especially, and this mass movement of people who don't want the country to be set up to pay interest to a small group of rich investors. They want the country to be set up to have more democratic approaches to finance. And it's interesting from our point of view today, maybe a little surprising to look back and see that many ordinary people who didn't have the kind of, you know, education that came with being a member of the small elite were very, very thoughtful and conscious about economics and finance policy and had their own ideas about taxation and debt and so forth. So that's a whole conflict that, you know, hasn't been discussed enough, I think. And it's relevant to today, of course, and it was there right at the beginning of the country.
It's a very interesting story that, as you say, doesn't get discussed much, and I hadn't really known much about it until I spent time with the book over the weekend. So let's sort of move to the centerpiece of the plot. What was Hamilton's vision for creation of the financial stability in the new nation as reflected in the three parts of what you call the Hamilton scheme?
Yeah, and this is where, you know, I'm glad you said plot, because, you know, the thing is, you get all these conflicts going, you know, it is a drama rather than just an analysis. And what he starts to do, and what he has to, it's very dramatic, his attempt to kind of get this stuff passed through Congress, because there was a lot of resistance. The very first U.S. Congress is having to deal with Hamilton's idea, this three-part idea, which was a combination of both getting Congress to agree to fund the public debt, not just pay it all off real quick, keep it going, potentially for a couple of generations, so that these rich families would be getting paid their investment money from, you know, their interest over a fairly long haul, get Congress to buy into that idea, because some people just were like, let's just get rid of this debt, pay it off as cheap as possible, and get it, and be debt-free, which is an argument we still have today. So that's one part, is just fund the debt. But the other thing that was really dramatic was he wanted the federal government to take over the individual debts of all the states, the individual war debts of all the states, ballooning the federal debt and wiping out the state's debt, which would make the federal government the kind of the sole source, really, of loans of this, of borrowing of this kind, and remove a certain amount of the state's power financially. So that was a real shocker to some people, and trying to get that through Congress. I mean, for, you know, politics junkies, the backroom stuff and the fights over that are pretty intense. And then thirdly, and critically, I think, the idea was to fund that debt by a dedicated tax, by dedicated taxes, so that you're paying the interest to the small number of, you know, wealthy investors by a tax that's kind of more widely spread around. So you're pulling money from some people who will never own one of these federal bonds in order to pay the bondholders. And the first domestic tax, the first tax on a domestic product ever passed in the United States was a tax on whiskey. And that was Hamilton's kind of brilliant way of doing it, was just to create an excise tax on whiskey. And this achieved many, many of his goals, including way beyond the finance piece. His big idea was to industrialize the country. And what he really wanted to do was take businesses like the distilling business, for example, and start, you know, privileging the kind of big commercial operators, consolidate that kind of business so that the small farmers would go out of that business and become laborers, and the big commercial industries would actually be the center of financial and economic and commercial action. So, of course, this was tremendously controversial. But this is what he pulled off. I mean, he got Congress to pass all three parts of that through great effort and extreme manipulation and just really good politics. And then add to that the central bank that he also got Congress to pass, or the national bank, I guess we should call it. It wasn't purely central. And that's his scheme, and what that leverages for him is the next step, which was like the industrialization of the whole country. So he had a very vaulting vision, and he actually also, on the nuts and bolts level, pulled it off politically.
You know, one of the things that comes out in the book, and I have a couple of questions. One of the things that comes out in the book is that Hamilton saw for a long time that the way to create a nation that was more of a nation than a group of quasi-independent states was that you had to have a tax. He was trying to pass a tax. I think with Robert Morris, the two of them sort of thought they had to pass a tax for, what, 15 years before they pulled it off?
Yeah, I mean, even in the Continental Congress, the Confederation Congress, a very different body from the U.S. Congress, they were trying to turn that body into a kind of national Congress by getting one federal tax passed. Because, you know, during the Revolution, only states could pass taxes. The Continental Congress had no power to do anything like that. They believed that if they could get the Continental Congress to pass a tax that would operate on citizens throughout all the states, then that would turn the Continental Congress into more like a national government. In the end, they failed at that, and that's why we had to have the Constitutional Convention from their point of view. They had failed to kind of push the Continental Congress, the Confederation Congress, push it kind of willy-nilly into becoming a national government through this taxation. So, okay, they finally gave up and said, we got to tear the whole thing down and start over with a new national government, and hence the Constitutional Convention. So I often say, you know, we don't think about these financial issues very much publicly in our discussions of the Constitutional Convention. But it's amazing to think of the way Hamilton looked at it, he was not alone in this, that the Constitution was in itself, as devised, a kind of financial technology. I mean, the idea was to give him the power to pull off these moves that we just talked about. The Constitution does create those powers. There were a lot of things that Hamilton and his cohort were frustrated by in the Constitution, but it gave them enough. And in a sense, it's a kind of a technology, like, okay, this is how we're going to do finance in a different way. And that is an unusual way, I know, to look at the Constitution. But it was the key thing is that it was very, very much the way Hamilton and his constituencies looked at the formation of the national government.
Perhaps my favorite number in the play is the number where they talk about the room where it happened. And that's where the argument in the play is that the only way he pulled this off was to trade the location of the national capital for the ability to pass some of these aspects of the plan. But in the book, you suggest that's probably not all that accurate, that it wasn't sort of a magic dinner that caused this. Can you explain?
Yes, and it's not just the play is following, you know, many other writers on this, where it has been generally believed for some time that Jefferson kind of brokered a deal between Madison and Hamilton over dinner in New York, when that's where the government was first sitting, to get the assumption deal that I just talked about, getting the states' debts absorbed and the federal debt. The reason people think that is that Jefferson said it a couple of times, and his feeling when he said it, which is often not quoted in context, his feeling when he said it was that he'd been duped basically by Hamilton into this system he believed was totally corrupt. He'd been duped into kind of helping to enable it, and he was really angry about it. There's some really interesting scholarship that I follow, it gets complicated in my endnotes, but I try to keep it as simple as I can in the actual narrative, where actually the drama was much more complicated than that. It was just not all done in a magical dinner. In fact, that dinner may have taken place. Jefferson probably didn't completely concoct it, but a lot of it would have been fairly irrelevant by the time they had that dinner. And it's sort of Jefferson putting himself at the center of a story that he's pretty irritated by at this point. And so the way I handle it in the book is like there's like five or six back rooms all going on at once, and nobody knows what's going on in all the other back rooms. It's just kind of a chaotic political horse trading situation. And yes, the location of the national capital was part of it, was one of the bargaining chips. But it's actually kind of, to me, funnier and more complicated and chaotic. Hamilton desperately trying to pull any move he could to make any deal with anybody to get this thing done. Many of these deals, really neither party could have even delivered on. But so it just becomes this kind of oddball, kind of slapstick situation in which finally he does prevail, but it's because a number of other kind of random things happened, as so often happens in politics. It's not all, you know, perfectly schemed out behind closed doors. Sometimes it's just chaos, and then something goes a certain way.
So then what was the long-term impact on the economy from all this?
Well, it kind of the long-term impact, in a way, was to sort of create an American economy, you could say, like just to have one, to have a national economy. I mean, I think I note somewhere in the book, like before there was a centralized, you know, treasury office for the whole country, Hamilton's office, it wasn't clear to everybody in the country, like, you know, I don't know how many, you know, what the national economy even was, what the state of commerce was, how many people lived there. I mean, they had to do a census, you know, all that stuff starts then. So the long-term impact, I'd say, is massive in the sense that it gave us an economy. There were ups and downs in Hamilton's tenure. I mean, he had to pull off two bailouts to prevent total financial collapse, sort of, you know, like true financial, you know, crisis, national financial crises, which he made amazing moves to kind of ameliorate and pull out of. So it wasn't all, you know, smooth. And then, you know, you get the other side of it, which is after, you know, in 1800, the Jeffersonians come in and they try to undo all of Hamilton's systems. And that's kind of the last part of my book, is the kind of, again, it's a sort of a tragicomic story of trying to undo everything Hamiltonian and finding it almost impossible to undo.
You know, you have to wonder how the nation would have looked had things played out differently. And I guess one of the questions that comes out of the book to me is, did his financial vision lead to sort of some of the inequality and consolidation of power that is so prevalent in our society today?
Well, I'd say yes. I think that the Hamilton, I don't know, trend in certain parts of our society and government is definitely dedicated to a kind of an aspect of inequality where, you know, if you're going to have, the way Hamilton would have looked at it, if you're going to have a powerful, dynamic nation, well, you're going to have to concentrate wealth, and you're going to use government power to concentrate wealth and the power of wealth to concentrate government. And so there's no question that in his mind, you know, a certain amount of inequality was totally acceptable and almost inevitable. And then you get the other side, which is sort of like, I mean, sometimes you get the Jeffersonians calling that Hamilton system corrupt, but you also get the third side I've been talking about, which is, you know, the ordinary people's movement, which isn't so interested in having a completely consolidated sort of empire-like dynamic going on in government, but much more interested in using power of government. They weren't anti-government, using the power of government to create more equal opportunity, and in some cases, more equal outcomes as well. So there we have, you know, arguments that are going on today, and I do think you can find their origins right here in the fights over the Hamilton scheme.
That's I'm going to back up just a little bit. When we were talking about the bailouts that Hamilton did, he was Secretary of the Treasury at that time.
Yes, he was. That's right.
So that's how he had the power to do that.
Yes, that's correct. And he used as much power as he could to intervene in the markets, you know, use the power of the federal government to intervene in the markets. And he made some very good moves. But on the other hand, he didn't want it to look like the only way his system would work is if the federal government constantly intervened in the markets. Yeah. So he had some tricky politics to pull off, as well as some tricky financial maneuvers, which, you know, you can read about in the book.
He certainly would have been a fascinating guy to have dinner with. One more question, and we probably should have covered this before in terms of the arc of the discussion. The Whiskey Rebellion. How did he react to it? How did it come about? And what did that tell us about his views about power?
Well, because of that tax on the first tax on the domestic product in the U.S., first federal tax on a domestic product, which was on whiskey, and it had all kinds of very regressive effects on small whiskey makers out west in western, what was then the Wild West, western Pennsylvania, which is hard to imagine now, but it really was. So it had these really regressive effects that people really objected to, and they were part and parcel of Hamilton's intention. It wasn't an accident. He did want to consolidate that industry around big players and put the small players out of business, as well as fund the debt. So it all worked together for him. For people who are actually working small artisanal distilling operations just to get themselves some incredibly scarce cash into their very cash poor operations, it was a total betrayal of the revolution to them. They felt like that tax was, you know, meet the new boss same as the old boss kind of attitude, and they rose up, and so they began by protesting, but that didn't get anywhere with Hamilton. So they started attacking tax collectors, and it became violent and terroristic. No question about it. And he and Washington made moves to suppress not just the whiskey rebels, but all of western Pennsylvania. They brought a 12,000-person army out there with Washington leading it, the commander-in-chief actually leading troops against American citizens, and they subjected the whole area to, you know, warrantless mass arrests and detention, indefinite detention, and military occupation. So it was a huge crackdown on what was actually a very dangerous situation, because some of the Whiskey Rebels were looking at secession, and it was definitely possible, potentially. Spain was right across the Mississippi River. It was a very volatile situation. So, and Hamilton was unabashed. He went along not just for the ride, but, you know, kind of led that operation to a great degree. Washington turned back. So it was really under Hamilton that a lot of these abuses of the Constitution, constitutional rights, took place. But he was absolutely unabashed about the idea that the United States had to show that it had the guts and the power and the capacity to, you know, assert its sovereignty and its laws, you know, everywhere in its jurisdiction. And so he was unconcerned about violations of individual rights. And you get a kind of an ugly climax to his career there. From his point of view, it was absolutely necessary, and so there it is. I mean, there's no real perfect resolution to that story.
There are lots of really interesting stories in this book. Covers a fascinating period of the nation's founding. Bill Hoagland, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Oh, thank you very much for a great discussion.
The book is The Hamilton Scheme, an epic tale, money and power and the American founding.
Just when you think it's time to build a wine cellar for your collection, along comes Bill De Leon and Mountain Wine Storage. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great. And you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking. So, can you tell us about Mountain Wine Storage? What is it? Where'd it come from?
Sure. So throughout much of the country, there are professional wine storage facilities, and they're designed to hold and store wine for collectors. What makes them special is that they're temperature controlled, they're humidity controlled, as opposed to just putting it in your closet, per se. So this came about because I moved out here a little over a year and a half ago after we've had a place here for a long time in Utah, and when we moved, I wanted to bring my wine collection here, but it didn't fit in my condo, and my wife said, you can't have boxes everywhere, and I wanted to store the wine correctly. So I spoke to a bunch of friends who thought this was a great idea and had the same problem I did. So we decided to look into building a wine storage facility.
So, Bill, let me ask you a question about wine itself. Why is it important to store it properly? What happens if you don't?
Two things happen. Well, wine is sensitive to temperature. Mm-hmm. So if it's not stored at the right temperature, the wine will denature. If the temperature changes too much, too quickly, it will denature, and it will not age correctly and or not be able to last, and it'll turn into something like vinegar. The other problem that you have is that there are wine corks. So the cork needs to have the correct amount of humidity, otherwise it'll dry out. Interestingly enough, a place like Utah with incredibly low humidity, that's definitely a problem. Also, if there's too much humidity, the corks will start to fall apart. So you want to have the right amount of humidity as well as the right temperature.
What's the range of the humidity?
You want to target somewhere between 50-ish to 70. Ideally, it would stay somewhere around 60% humidity. Temperature, you want to ideally have it about 55 degrees. It can vary as long as it varies slowly, and it stays within a range.
What's too hot for wine? Because I know I lost a lot of wine many years ago.
If it starts getting above 70 for a prolonged period of time, it's a problem. If it gets above 80, it's definitely a real problem.
Gotcha. So I imagine Park City has experienced a big growth in the past few years since COVID. And I imagine others were just like you. They came here with their wine collections and said, well, where am I going to keep it? Are these people finding you some way?
We opened the end of July, and we've actually gotten quite a few clients in. We had pent-up demand for this, and now we're focusing on trying to get the word out, educate people that we have this facility and that they can store their wine with us.
And where is the facility?
We're out in Heber. We're on Airport Road. As you know, with the growth of Utah, especially up here, finding commercial space is not necessarily easy. And we wanted to find a convenient location which would make the business work. Heber is 20, 25 minutes from downtown Park City, and it's easy to get to.
So are people having a dinner party and saying, oh, geez, I need that 62 Chateau Margaux? Do they just zip down to, do they have 24/7 access?
No, we are open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 6. We can make special arrangements for you. And if you're having a 62 Margaux, please invite me.
Okay, so how big is the facility? And describe a little physically about how it's laid out and how you maintain temperature and humidity control.
We have about a 9,000 square foot facility.
Wow.
We rented four different parts of a large industrial storage facility. So we have about literally half the building. When we started building it, we worked with the landlord. We upgraded the insulation to be R45, which is much higher insulation than you would find for standard housing or, mm-hmm. or things like that. We installed three industrial air conditioners, which is redundant, so we can have one of them go out. We installed a industrial backup generator, which is gas powered. Believe it or not, we got to test that this summer and it worked. Someone took out a power line for the whole area. And we installed four industrial humidifiers as well as four industrial dehumidifiers. And then there are individual lockers. So when you rent storage from us, you come into the facility and you have your own individual locker, or some people have multiple of them. Lockers range anywhere from approximately 12 cases all the way to a walk-in closet with over 500 cases.
500 cases, oh, I love it. So you have half the building. Let's say by the end of this year, you fill up. Are you able to expand, or do you have to start a new location?
I'd love to have that problem. So we'd have to start a new location. So,
gotcha.
We have built out part of the facility, and as we grow, we'll continue to build out more. If people want custom solutions, we're glad to work with them as well.
So I'm trying to visualize what's it like. I walk in the front door and you're open from 10 to 6. So I say hello to the person. Is there somebody sitting there?
There's somebody in there.
Okay, so I walk in. What am I seeing?
I actually have to walk through two doors because we want to limit the exchange of air.
It's like an airlock.
It's an air, yeah. And then you walk into the facility and you will see rows of lockers. So we started with industrial pallet lockers and then built out custom lockers using both a combination of wood and chain link fence. And you would get an individual locker and you'd have a padlock on it so that your wine is segregated from everybody else's.
And I said industrial, and so I walk, I open up my locker. Are there industrial, like, shelves in there where my wine's
no,
sitting?
No, you have, the standard would be just a big space.
So I could stack my wine.
You'd stack your wine in boxes, and if you want, we could build for you individual racking.
So there's a chain link fence, so if I have my Opus One, whatever, I can see my next door neighbor's 62 Chateau Margaux or something?
You could, yes.
Ooh, that's envious, huh?
Okay, yeah. So this is a business show. You knew we were going to ask this question. Talk to us about price points.
Price points are depending on the size of the locker and the term of the contract. So most people get annual contracts, and we have standard pricing for that. We do monthly rentals. We do charge about 10 to 15% more for a monthly rental. And the pricing is based upon the size of the locker and the location of the locker. So the lockers that are closer to the ground are slightly more expensive than the ones that are higher. Our lockers go up 12 feet, so if you have one of the top tier lockers, it'll be cheaper because you need to use a ladder. Some people do get that because they want to put their wine down for a very long time, and they're just going to get it infrequently. And the average pricing, depending on the size of the locker, is slightly over $2 a bottle.
So at ground level, compared to 12 feet, is there a temperature difference, or do you have fans keeping it circulating?
We have fans keeping it. Okay. So there are actually, as I said, there are three industrial air conditioners. Those are outside. And we have six industrial blowers inside the unit circulating the air at all times. The security system actually has, we have glass break, we have motion detector, we have over 27 cameras. And additionally, we have temperature monitors and humidity monitors that are all going to a 24/7 monitoring system, company. So in the event that an alarm goes off for any of those reasons,
they wake you up?
They will wake us up, and they'll also send the police. So we do take security of our clients' wine very seriously. And as I said, my wine's personally there.
Yeah. So is it just wine, or can I put old bottles of whiskey or some Cuban cigars?
Whiskey, no, but Cuban cigars, yes.
Okay. Now, are you the only one in the area, or is there anything like it in Summit, Wasatch, maybe down in Salt Lake?
We are the only facility in Utah. We are the first and only. So our marketing people said that's a great story, which we thought was true. So we think that with the growth of Utah and the continued movement of people, this will continue to take off.
And are you feeling like, I'm sure that there's a spreadsheet somewhere that you drew up before you did this, where you projected best case, worst case, medium case. How are you doing vis-a-vis sales? Are you on track for where you want to be?
We're a little bit behind. Mm-hmm. Part of that was because construction was much slower than we hoped, which... As you know, everything
by definition.
So we received the building 4 months later than we were supposed to from the landlord, and then we had to go through our construction. So between delays and inspections and everything, we didn't get full business approval to the end of July, which was months behind. As I said, we had a pent-up demand, so mm-hmm. that was very nice. Now we're sort of in the slow season, so we're hoping once people start to come back for ski season and people start becoming more and more aware, we'll get a pickup of new clients during ski season.
And if our listeners want to become new clients, how can they find your website? How can they learn how to contact you?
Sure. Our website is mountainwinestorage.com. You can send us an email, info@mountainwinestorage.com. Those will be the best ways to get in touch. Our pricing is online. We have pictures of our facility. We have an FAQ section for discussing much of what we talked about here. And we're glad to have people come out and give them a tour and work with them. One of the other services we do provide is wine inventory. So for people who, like me, who have huge collections of wine and may not know exactly what you have or what box it is in, we will inventory your wine using commercial wine software, and you can go online, see what wine you have, what box it's in, and then we can actually pull that box for you when you want to come, or pull specific wines for you so you don't have to spend the time doing that.
Thank you very much. So that's Bill DeLeon with Mountain Wine Storage. Again, mountainwinestorage.com. Bill, thank you very much for sharing your information and your business idea. Utah is a state with a strong entrepreneurial spirit. Boy, that's a tough word. Successful businesses are celebrated. We're joined by Kevin Jessup and Chris Badger, who will share information about the Utah 100 Awards. Gentlemen, good morning. Let's start off with, please tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you're each connected to the Utah 100 Awards.
Well, my name is Kevin Jessup. I work for IMA. I'm the director of marketing there, and I'm also the current president of the Mountain West Capital Network. I've been with this organization for a couple of decades now. It's a great organization, and you know, we're a networking organization comprised of capital providers, supporting service providers, high growth companies. We recognize and celebrate corporate excellence at all levels.
Excellent. And Chris?
Awesome. My name is Chris Badger. I'm a partner with Now CFO here in Salt Lake City. So I'm one of those accounting geeks. I call it a recovering CPA. I haven't been on the Mountain West Capital Network as long as Kevin, but I've been on the Board of Trustees for the last 9 years. And this year I was the chair for the Utah 100 Committee.
And just so people can understand a little more, is Mountain West Capital, is it kind of like a trade association for businesses? Is that the kind of structure you guys are?
You know, really we're, okay, so it's comprised mostly of capital providers, right, and supporting service providers. But we also have a lot of high growth companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is to get together deal makers, companies that are searching for, you know, money for recognition, and capital providers and the service providers that support those businesses. The companies that we honor and that we recognize with our various events, you know, comprise tens of thousands of employees and employers, a significant chunk of the Utah economy, with a focus on the fastest growing segment.
So the word network in your name is actually sort of fundamental to your mission, which is you are essentially a networking between capital providers and capital consumers. Tell us about the Utah 100 Awards. How long have they been around, and what are you trying to do with them?
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit of a background on the Utah 100 Award event. We just celebrated our 30th anniversary here a couple weeks ago, the Grand America. And so the Mountain West Capital Network, we've put this together over the past 30 years. And remember, all the people that work on the committees and the verifying, they're all volunteers. We start this process back in May, and we take applications for companies that think they're fast growing. And so between May 1st and June 30th, we do the applications. There's no fee to apply. We want to be very upfront. This is an award that we want to give out. It's not a pay to play. We want the right companies. The committee goes through and validates all that information, you know, by either tax records or audited financials, and working with the CFOs and the companies to verify and vet that. The winning companies, they're eligible in three different award categories, starting with the top 15 revenue. And these are revenue growth over the past 5 years. So from 2019 to 2023. And you think of that time period, think of everything that happened in 2020 with the COVID shutdowns and other things. And so these are for companies that have had sustained high growth during that period. So again, the first award is the top 15 revenue. The second is the Utah 100. This is the mainstay. This is where companies are ranked according to a weighted average of a percentage of dollar growth over that same five-year period from 2019 to 2023. And then our third category, think of it as kind of like the startups. It's the emerging elite. It's the companies that haven't been in business more than 5 years, but they've got some growth, they're emerging, and they're eventually going to be on the Utah 100 awards.
So is there any specific size company that's, is there a requirement for a company to be more than a sole proprietor or giant like Delta or Adobe?
No, we have some really large companies that are in our top revenue. We've got Zions Bank, Layton Construction, huge companies. And we also have some smaller companies that are, you know, sole proprietorships. We've got a great one that's just up in Park City, a local Park City company, Abode Luxury Rentals.
Oh, yeah.
They've been on the list for 8 years, and they're ranked number 81. and they've been a great example of a company that provides a way for people wanting to experience the beauty and wonder and all the adventures here in Utah. So the Sustained Growth and Abode is a representation of a company that provides a great service for tourists and locals. And they've been on the committee. They've been on the award for 8 years.
When I look, go ahead, Chris.
One of those defining factors, they must have $100,000 in revenues for that year one. You know, it's a 5-year trailing average, right? And so it's the growth rate that we're measuring that is just so impressive. So a company that's been on there for 8 years, that's massive.
When I look at the list of the Utah 100, one of the things that strikes me was the incredible range of corporations and businesses and the things they do here in Utah. I wonder if we could spotlight a couple of them. For example, can we talk a little bit about the one that captured the number one spot, Pure Healthcare? Who are they? What do they do?
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about them. So Pure Healthcare, they've been on the Utah 100 awards list. This is their second year, and they administer a lower cost infusion therapy experience for their patients that have chronic illnesses, and that includes oncology. And in 7 years, they've grown to 43 locations in 14 states. They've got a great backstory. They've got some founders that had been selling infusions and pharmaceuticals to hospitals and to clinics for years. And they realized that people going in for infusions just weren't treated the best in hospitals, because you had to go, think of it, you go to a hospital, you got to check in the front desk, then you got to go to the department, then you got to sit and wait. Pure Health has done is they've really kind of put that up on edge, and you go to a place that I think of it as a spa. Mm-hmm. You go in there, you've got your infusion set up, you've got a nice nurse practitioner set you up. You go in there, you've got a lazy boy chair. You got a lazy boy chair for your companion. You can sit there. You've got music. You've got TVs. It's a whole different experience. And these guys at Pure Health, they've taken what's been done at hospitals and clinics for the last 50 years, and they've just set it on edge. And they've made it a much better experience for their patients.
And at a much reduced cost.
The cost savings going from a hospital setting to a clinic is tremendous. And they are really poised for even more explosive growth. I think they're going to be very successful.
Now, do you pick the businesses? Do they apply? I think you said something, there's no cost, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they do have to apply. And so every year we take those applications for the months of May and June.
Okay.
And so they do need to apply. And then after that, in July and August timeframe, we go out and verify and vet those numbers that are on the application. But it is through an application process.
And how many applications did you receive this past May and June, would you say?
Hundreds and hundreds. There's a lot of companies that want to be part of it. This is the first and the largest award program in the state of Utah. It's great recognition, and we love the companies that are part of it, and there's lots of other companies that want to be part of it.
Now, we touched on a healthcare company. One of the things we hear a lot about is the Silicon Slopes and sort of the presence of high tech in Utah. What are some examples that popped up on the Utah 100 this year from the technology sector?
Sure. We can, let me get you a couple. We have a great one, e-learning. So ELB Learning has been on the awards list for a few years. We've got OpConnect, another tech company up in Kaysville. We've got some startups or more startup emerging with ProDataKey, and plenty of other tech companies that are represented. We've got LVT, Blue Eye Monitoring. There's a heavy dose of tech companies. Mm-hmm. There's also lots of construction, mm-hmm. e-commerce. Yeah. And so we have, it's kind of like Utah,
yeah.
Small and medium-sized businesses rule here in Utah. And so we get a very wide variety of different types of companies, but Silicon Slopes, there's lots of tech companies and software companies that are representative.
So you range all the way from tech to companies like that deal with medical. And then I even saw Overstock on the list after some 22 years.
Yes, yeah. And the growth they've had with e-commerce and online sales, and think of all of those marketing opportunities for those types of companies. It's really representative of what I call the whole state, the whole great state of Utah.
Well, wonderful. So now what is the website that our listeners can log into?
Learn more.
Put in their calendar next May and June so they can be in the running.
We'd love for them to come to mwcn.org. That's for Mountain West Capital Network, the acronym there.
Well,
Mountain West Capital Network, mwcn.org, and they can apply right there.
Wonderful. We were just joined by Chris Badger and Kevin Jessup, representing the Utah 100 Awards.